DLI, Delta Lithium.
Interested, mate. The moment I can smell a little bit of shareholder activism.
Oh, hook, line and sinker.
The important bit of information here, Matty, is there's an AGM on the 29th of November. Do you think that Waratah's plan here is accumulating some shares to have some influence on the voting on some of the resolutions at the upcoming AGM?
Righto, g'day, Money Mourners. Today, Trav has enlightened me on you. Continue to surprise me every day, Trav. Mayer Resources, Lime in PNG. The education for myself and the Money Mourners continues. Mate, we are going into bit of WA1 results. Regal buying half of Taurus and New World Copper's royalty funding that's just come through. Mate,
There's a bit going on, mate.
But there's a bit going on. Bit of a quiet news day.
You're forgetting Delta as well. I really want to talk about Delta and maybe some shareholder activism tied into that, because that really gets me excited.
Now, that is an AGM that I want to go to, Trav. Very much so. Mate, let's rip into it and tell you what, we've got to rip into these guys who are going to have lunch with after this. So quite pertinent that we're presenting KCA Site Services to the Money Miners today, the machinery hire specialist for the wild, wild underground mining industry. Trav, now I have a new bit of a term I want to introduce for an unexpected underground event. We're going to call it a call KCA moment. This is what it is. So a bit of underground mining mayhem to get things rolling. So look at this. Here's the picture of the KCA Volvo L120FIT integrated tool carrier. Looks bloody good. But let's look at what can happen in the underground environment. Now, that right there is a call KCA moment.
Well, how the hell does that happen? So this is that is one of them that's flipped on its side.
Yeah, not a KCA IT, it's some other IT, but yes, it is obviously the balance and inertia has made it go on its side. That's the jib trying to flip it back over. Gotcha. So, mate, KCA, they've got seven new Volvo L120Fs coming between February and April 2024, and these are the last ones of the traditional F series. You can't buy them anywhere else. Seven of them on the way, mate. They've also got available for hire right now the 1614B charge wagon. Have a look at it. Look at that. What a beautiful piece of machinery.
What's a charge? This is probably a dumb
explosives.
Question. Explosives. Right.
Yeah, that's got the bomb in it. Jam the explosives.
So charge up uses that?
That's correct, mate. And now we'll forward onto this one. This is the front of one after the underground has won. Crushed.
Oh my gosh.
Charge basket. That's a call KCA moment.
That is a call KCA moment.
Call KCA. Now,
Explain that to the audio listener. What the hell is going on there?
Well, I'd say that's run into a wall and the wall has won. Simple as that. General physics. Mate, they've also got mine spec and underground spec light vehicles, LVs as we call them. Look at that one. Nice and shiny.
Beautiful.
Nice, beautiful KCA sticker.
Lovely.
Here we go. That's a call KCA moment.
I remember when we were
Ran into a truck.
Were underground.
Well, the trucks ran into it.
Who's the maintenance people? The most common thing is people driving trucks hitting stuff and they have to fix stuff as a result.
That's a carton.
That's it.
Anyway, we can't
call KCA moment.
Yeah, we can't talk about that sort of stuff around clients. But mate, that's a cool KCA moment. Now they've also got available for the Sandvik 551 truck. Have a look at those beautiful KCA stickers. Mate, Adam Wilson, if you're bloody listening, mate, I hope you got shitloads more of those stickers available, because after a month or so of rubbing walls and buckets scratching them, those stickers won't even be there. So, mate, they've got also available for hire right now, one time only. They've got the Normet bloody flatbed stores truck here, pretty much good for carting any of that toweled up stuff out of the ground, rubbish or anything that is good. Take it up surface, put it into a new home, probably the rubbish tip usually. So, mate, the thing I like about KCA, Trav, like, ex-underground miners.
Yeah.
Because I'm telling you, I've seen some wild shit happen underground
and
some creative things to fix stuff to keep the dirt coming out of the hole.
Usually involves duct tape to fix it?
No is not an acceptable answer. No is never an option. can-do attitude, and Casey, I've taken that into the business, and I bloody like that.
Next time I have any issue in life, mate, I'm just going to call Casey A.
Just call Casey A. If something breaks at home, whether it's a toaster, a kettle, even
Adobe Premiere Pro fucking crashing, call Casey A.
Anything. I hear they're diversifying. Any ITs, trucks, anything, non-mining related, it's a call Casey A moment.
Oh, I love it. I love it, mate. I hope that one catches on in the industry. Just call KCA.
Call KCA. Mate, Terra Capital, our great friends Langers and Bondi, who run the Terra Capital Natural Resources Fund, based in my favourite place in the world that I would never be able to live in, Sydney, New South Wales. But, Trav, we harp on about Langers and Bondi for good reason, obviously, but there is another great friend.
There is.
That we have at Terra Capital. Now, before we allude to this man, or I'll just refer to this AFR Street Talk article that I've just found on the old good Google internet.
I can read this out. The headline, Ord Minnett Mining Whiz joins Bond's Natural Resources Fund.
Picture of Bondi there, but they didn't. Ord Minnett mining analyst Dylan Kelly, also known as DK, has made the jump to the buy side after 10 years of trading research. Kelly this week got his feet under the desk at Jeremy Bond's $185 million natural resources boutique Terra Capital as its new head analyst. Mate, how good. What a talk up there.
How is it that Langers and Bondi always get these like profiles of themselves in AFR where they look just bloody striking?
Oh,
I don't understand. Everyone else they put photos in just look horrible, but they've bloody got some real
If we hone in on that picture of Bondi there, doesn't that give you that look? Just says it's going to be all right. You're in Bondi's house now. It's just got that feel about it, doesn't it? And that's probably like when DK went in for the interview. Bondi probably gave him that similar sort of pose, and DK was like, "I know this is my new home." And it's like that. I'm getting that feeling from this article. So, mate, Terra, DK, Langers, Bondi, thanks for all your support.
Love
your
DK.
Work. And fuck, I love talking about him too.
I love
my favourite part of the day.
I had a wicked conversation over dinner with DK and sharing some like good bromance around talking about what we sort of look like fraudulent companies that you're going deep into them.
As you were talking to DK, Langers was sitting next to me and said, "Look over there, they are the two most cynical people in the Australian finance sector right there." So quite pertinent to what you said. Righto, let's rip in Ricky Ardenio. Mate, MRL, and when you say MRL, you think mineral resources, but
that's
it's
why
not.
I clicked on the announcement. I was like, what's going on?
MRL, Mayer Resources, M-A-Y-U-R. Appian to debt fund lime project in Papua New Guinea. Mate, I know you love random shit and I love Papua New Guinea. Mate, take it away. What's going on?
100%. So I'm just so aware of your love for Papua New Guinea. It's been, I think, 2 months since we've even spoken about the great country.
It's similar reason to why you love potash.
Yeah, well potash is an industrial mineral and lime is an industrial mineral. So I think it's all related, mate. Like this is your love and my love in the one story, and
we love each other.
Yeah. I love you, mate.
Fuck, we do now that we're making a bit of money. She was a bit tight. She was a bit fragile when we were broke. Right, mate. What's fucking take it away? Head across the ditch.
All right. So we've got Mayer Resources, ticker MRL, like you said, and I've read this announcement, and I'm like, what is Appian doing funding a lime project in PNG? Like, that's a sentence you don't say very often in mining, Maddie. So let's have a chat about lime projects. And despite my love for industrial minerals, lime is not one I've done a deep dive on before. So to all of the lime experts out there, I apologize in advance.
Oh, there'd be a few.
If it's obvious, I'm now talking out of my ass. So this project in PNG, they call it the Central Lime Project. In phase one, it's a low capex startup to build an initial kiln and produce quick lime. Phase two, there's a clinker and cement facility. And I think that might be the appeal of the project. It's right next door to PNG LNG, massive operation part owned by Exxon and Santos. And you can obviously think of the cost advantages in the production of cement there. So the news today, though, is in relation to this debt funding package. And there's some recognisable mining financiers in the mix, Maddie, despite it being a very tricky jurisdiction to navigate. Appian, they're one of those London-based mining private equity groups, mate, and they've raised some pretty big funds in recent history. I'm pretty sure I read a headline earlier in the year where they just raised another $2 billion fund. But private equity in mining, a bit maligned. There have been some big names. They always raise these enormous funds because it's a model that the big endowments and pension funds in the US are comfortable allocating towards, a private equity model. But the private equity returns in mining have not been so straightforward. And so it's just way that the big money is comfortable allocating, but the model is sometimes a little bit questionable.
29 metals.
EMR.
not a good return for EMR. Yeah.
So who are the big private equity? Appian and I think RCF are probably the two biggest private equity ones. Then you've got, EMRs. There's a whole bunch out there. But anyway, so back to Appian, right? What is this debt package that they've tipped into? They have agreed to a non-binding term sheet to provide US $90 million of debt funding at the project level there. So that $90 million bucks is going to get them, they're going to receive an interest rate priced at SOFR plus 8%, and they're also going to get a royalty for 2.5% of the gross revenue over the life of the mine too. They get security on the asset.
Good royalty and good interest rate.
Yep.
Yeah,
the interest, it's priced. Priced high, right? But with that debt facility, I mean, you need a really high hurdle to invest in PNG, right? Like you kind of have a jurisdiction premium on a lot of your investment stuff, and your return on capital depends accordingly.
So, what's actually really attracted your attention to this, Trav? What's the intriguing bit?
There's another part of the financing of this project, which is one of those, financier brands that I look at every time, and I'm like, oh, interesting that they're involved, right? So Appian's one. The other one is the party coming to play for the equity contribution. So there's the debt. The equity contributor is US $40 million from Vision Blue. If that fund isn't familiar to you yet, because they've only been around a few years, well, the name Sir Mick Davies would be familiar to you. Big mining name based over in London, from Xstrata kind of fame. He's got a sir at the front. How many mining people are knighted, right? Like, not many.
Well, the cricketers get knighted easier over there.
Exactly. I mean, mining, to get knighted in mining is a pretty big deal. This fund. Sir Matty Michael. That has a ring to it.
They don't do sirs anymore, actually.
Don't they?
I think they cancelled it. But they might bring it back for us. But anyway.
Don't you become one of those people on LinkedIn that has like 10 extensions to your name, and you bloody go pay for a doctorate at some crappy university and you call yourself Dr. Matty Michael.
I won't do it, mate.
Good.
Guaranteed.
All right. So Mick Davies, he started this like battery metals fund called Vision Blue a few years ago. They're tipping in $40 million at the project level for 49% interest in that project. Their interest was first announced in August and ultimately finalized in an announcement 2 days ago. Vision Blue, mate, that fund that is run by Mick Davies is just a really interesting project financier that's popped up in the last few years in the mining finance world. I've been looking at their investments since they popped up, and a lot of their investments are in projects that you kind of scratch your head and think, if Vision Blue wasn't there and it didn't have Mick Davis's name next to it, would that project have ever gotten financed? That's what I think about every one of their kind of, about most of the projects that they've had a role in to date. I'll run through a couple of them. So you can group the Central Line project into that category. Another one is Nexor. So it's a graphite project in Madagascar. There's a vanadium project in Kazakhstan, a quartz mine in British Columbia, a tin developer in the UK. Those are kinds of commodities in jurisdictions.
British Columbia, not bad, but a quartz mine.
I mean,
I wonder if it's got any gold in the
tin mine in the UK. Yeah, I mean, like vanadium in Kazakhstan. Yeah. So anyway, they're just the kinds of commodities and jurisdictions you usually just tilt your head, you raise an eyebrow, and you're like, huh?
Tin in the UK, trying to get Cornwall back up and going.
That's it.
Is it in Cornwall?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. That's exactly it. And I'm not doubting the project selection from Sir Mick Davies. I'm just watching closely, and I have a bit of a a hypothesis of the funding dynamics. Like there was a lot of investor appetite for battery metals mining investment. So you could raise a fund and that's your mandate and you got to do that, right? But the opportunity set to allocate that capital in the time frame you've got to allocate it while taking, you know, the right bite-sized hits at each respective investment each time and getting, you know, a return hurdle threshold met in your valuation model that you need to, it's really hard to do that. And the opportunity set is super slim. So I think the net result of that is you probably end up financing projects in funky jurisdictions, funky commodities, and in funky ways. And I'm just going to pay attention to how all of that pans out, because I think some of those criteria might lead to some great returns, but maybe some bad ones too. Back to the Meyer announcement though, Maddie. There's a bit I don't like. So on top of that debt and equity that we spoke to kind of fund the project, they also announced a $10 million funding package today, $9 million of which is debt at an interest rate of 15%, a 2% underwrite fee, a 2.5% arrangement fee, plus a bunch of attaching options, which on my numbers are equivalent to another 4.5% fee, equals a 24% cost of debt. They went into halt a week ago. Since then, the Vision Blue investment has firmed up. They've announced Appian is there for the debt. Surely, like that's kind of enough good news about project development that they could have raised some equity at the company level with a lower cost of capital than, you know, 24% cost of debt on my numbers. That's my thoughts on that one. When you go to the actual project, you look at the project, that stage one DFS shows the project only has an IRR of 24%. So, you want to be careful about gearing something when your cost of debt might be higher than the IRR. Imagine going into a trading hold a week ago like they did, announcing these big names sort of they're now funding it, these big mining names they're funding it. And since now your project is now kind of, you know, the pathway to it being developed is a lot more clear. But they come out of halt today and they're trading again today and the share price falls 27%. So make of that what you will. I talked to some financiers and they said that the opportunity to kind of fund this sort of project has come around a few times over the years and it's one that has been passed over historically. And I think there's a broader comment on capital allocation. You know, I mentioned what my thoughts are around Vision Blue, maybe those thresholds are, but even for Appian to do this deal, like when you are a private equity fund, you raise a fund, you've got a time frame to deploy that capital and you might go further out on the risk curve and do funkier stuff when, you know, when some deadlines might be approaching about having to deploy that capital before X date.
Is this technique by Vision Blue, is it a... Can it be so when you go on these debt arrangements in risky jurisdictions, risky commodities, it's a high risk to lend that money. Yep. Is it a way to potentially pick up the projects for very cheap later on if the owner fails?
Well, here's my question to you. I think sometimes the thought process around project financing, like something that's funky and you can pick up the project on the cheap, is not always like a clear strategy, because if the project doesn't work, and I'm not saying that's the case here, but like sometimes project finance comes in and the lender thinks, oh, my worst case scenario is I'll, you know, like the equity will go to zero, but me as the debt holder, I'll get my money back because I can sell the asset later on. That's the wrong way to think about it, because if a project doesn't work, you often can't sell the project for what the outstanding debt balance is. Mm. I can think of a bunch, but there's a lot of instances where it goes broke and the creditors don't get their money back either.
Yeah, and but there is the way. If it doesn't work the first time, it might work the second time from those learnings and the debt provider gets the benefit of it.
There's a big tendency to be persuaded by sunk cost in this industry. Like a big selling point for a lot of mining projects is there's $500 million of sunk cost at this project. And like
replacement cost of the mill.
Yeah, Walloon is a wicked example, right? How many times has that, like, the pitch of that project been like, the sunk capital at this project is bloody $500 million, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, it was $700 million.
Doesn't matter how much money has been spent, the NPV can still be negative of spending new money there.
Yeah, and all the sunk capital all is probably rusted out and gone to shit by the time been sitting there doing nothing. All the motors are seized.
Yeah, if there's a resource issue, which a lot of projects that get financed and they get into trouble, there's a resource issue. Sunk capital doesn't fix a resource issue.
Nah. Interesting, mate. So. Mate, WA1, now I'm approaching this with caution because they are infill drilling results. And I will have a shout out to Bellevue Gold because I didn't report their infill drilling results one day. So I'm not going to report what these infill drilling results are. I'm hyper conscious of giving every company fair treatment.
It's a slow news day, mate.
It is, but ding, ding, ding for you. You're a shareholder in this one.
And so is JD. And so for that reason, discount everything we say.
Yeah, but the one thing that did stand out about these infill drilling results in – which is in a contrast to most other ASX companies, is normally you would see any drill results, whether they're infill, exploration, whatever, extensional, they're ordered by the best to the worst.
Yes, in the list of the dot points on the highlights.
Yeah, usually the best at the top, yada, yada, yada. WA1 have actually ordered theirs in ascending order based on the drill hole ID number, and their best hit is actually the second last one in the table, which is an absolute stonker. So that's a good indication of how things are looking at the Looney deposit trap. But, oh, Jesus, look at the bloody share price fly. Up another 13% today, $10.68. Share price was $1.30 in April. We first spoke about it in June. I think that's after it had the first rocket to $5.50.
Is that when we had Bogan and Manuel Dad on?
Bogan and Daddy, yeah. And then it traded sideways for sort of sideways for 4.5 months. But now from that point, it's doubled again. So absolutely. So
you could
it's
see,
a 10-bagger from that point in April.
Yeah, and you could see Regal buying. I think they increased their ownership in a change of substantial that was released the other day. The other fascinating thing about it when you're just talking share price and everything is because it was such a short period of time from IPO to discovery, like most exploration companies that have exploration success, they live a very long life before that. And as a result of living a long life, their share price is in the like cents or whatever. WA1 never had that long life. It was IPO, then discovery. And so I don't think it's a like a super large company from a market cap perspective, something like $500 million or thereabouts, right? Yet a share price of $10 a share, which is so interesting. You never really see a $500 million company or whatever with a $10 share price.
Yeah, exactly. Mate, DLI, Delta Lithium. Mate, what's about you? You got a bit of a YouTube prompt for this one, did you?
Yeah, this is wicked. I mean, they know how to get me interested, mate. The moment I can smell a little bit of shareholder activism,
line and sinker. Yeah.
Now combine shareholder activism with some big identities in our industry, and all of a sudden, like, I'm bloody hooked to this story, even though it's not even really a story yet, but it could be, Maddie, and that's what matters. Okay. So there was someone on YouTube video yesterday. I think it was yesterday. They clued me onto this one, and good on them. Like, I'm there for it. Do you remember that Toronto-based fund that owned about 10% of Delta Lithium, Waratah Capital?
Yep.
I think Flano he listed them in our chat with him back in the day as a very savvy battery metals investor, something along those lines.
Flano, if you're listening, mate, just pop in the office and say good day sometimes if you don't mind. We'd love to catch up with you.
So Waratah have been buying Delta shares as the share price has continued to sell off since MinRes popped up with a 20% interest and 2 board seats. Bit of context here. You can deduce from the change in substantial notices that Waratah Capital have been buying on market since the 14th of September. The board changes were announced 12th of September. So 12th of September, Chris Allison, Josh Thurlow joining the board, Flano out, all the likes, right? 2 days later, Waratah start buying on screen amid a lot of other people who were Delta shareholders sort of selling because the rest of the market is clearly, you know, like sees the fact that MinRes have some sort of de facto control as a negative. Share price sells off. Waratah, intriguingly, accumulating. And the big question, right, is why? Why are Waratah accumulating? And the important bit of information here, Maddie, is there's an AGM on the 29th of November. And I reckon that Waratah will be amongst a group of unhappy Delta Lithium shareholders at the fact that MinRes appear to have a de facto control of their company, despite only owning 20%. But you know, they've got two board seats. Like you rarely sort of see that. Those board seats, of course, being Chris Allison himself and Josh Thurlow.
I think they're actually, I'll just confirm that. I think it's 17.4% that MinRes own.
Oh, there you go, mate.
Just looking at it. Number, it's under Lithium Resources Operations, 17.44. So unless, does Ellison have 2.4? Something.
I trust you on the numbers.
Looking at the
recent I'm rounding up,
yeah,
right?
So 17.4.
Yeah. So given the unhappy shareholders around, do you think that Waratah's plan here is accumulating some shares to have some influence on the voting on some of the resolutions at the upcoming AGM? So let's look at some of those resolutions up for shareholder vote. You got adoption of the REM report standard, election of Chris Allison of MinRes, election of Josh Thurlow of MinRes, election of Steve Kovac of Idemitsu, yep, who are also a large shareholder, and there's a re-election of Nader El-Sayed. So there's some retail punters out there who might choose to vote in the AGM for the first time that they've ever voted in an AGM because they're grumpy, right? And I'm hearing that there is a bit of a campaign to vote against resolutions 2 and 3 in particular, and potentially even 4. So let's see how that goes, right?
Because that's going to be interesting to see what the proxy numbers come through.
In the case of voting for the election of Chris Allison and the election of Josh Thurlow, like MinRes's ownership, like MinRes's vote doesn't count. So, like, and then if you got Waratah Capital buying with the intention of voting against, I don't know what their intentions are, then Idemitsu probably plays ball and votes for, Waratah against. What do the proxy advisors do in this situation? I don't know, but they probably control the sway. And then you might have a bunch of retail who are motivated and choose to vote against.
So Idemitsu's vote wouldn't count either, yeah?
When it comes to the resolution for Steve Kovac himself, it doesn't count.
But
when
they,
it
comes to they can vote on.
Idemitsu can vote on Chris Allison, Josh Thurlow.
That'd be because Idemitsu, 14.66%.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Interesting one to watch, Maddie. I think we should go to that AGM.
Oh, shit, yeah. So what that, because that'd take, so if you take MinRes's 17.4, take another maybe 10% that don't vote. Like that's down to what, 70?
Well, it's more than 10. Heaps of people don't vote.
Yeah, so yeah. Say it's 20. So that takes you down to, let's say it takes you down to closer to 60% of the shareholders. So if Waratah get 20, that's effectively their vote's worth 30-odd percent, possibly.
Waratah's vote's going to matter a lot. And then there'll be a lot of sub 5% shareholders around and about that their vote will matter as well. Retail probably have a voice in this one.
It sounds it. That's going to be very interesting, right?
Really interesting.
Yes, I will be. I might have to put some pants and shoes on for that day.
No, boardies and thongs, mate. That's your attire.
Yeah, no. I might buy some shares before, just so we're guaranteed to get.
Yeah, I don't want to be kicked out. Actually, you're probably right. We should probably buy $500 worth of shares. Like, yeah,
$500 worth of shares
the day before the
$200 whatever. Worth of clothes to get in there. That'd be bloody good, mate. Regal. We mentioned them in WA1, but Regal, this happened while we were in Sydney, buying 50% of Taurus.
Yep.
Yeah, so we saw that last week. We haven't actually mentioned it yet. So
no.
Look, two really big names in the mining funds management universe and industry, mate.
I think
what's the play here?
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? So Regal announced that they're buying 50% of Taurus. Regal, obviously, long short hedge fund spearheaded by Phil King, play a really, really, really big role in Australian equity markets. People love to hate them.
Massive role in exploration, the amount of exploration that wouldn't happen because of them.
Cornerstoning equity raises is a big deal. Like, people get grumpy because, you know, they often sell down their stock, but it's all part of the strategy. And if it didn't exist,
they wouldn't be drilling.
So, yeah. And then Taurus, they're a bit of an alternative funds management. And see, they do a lot of the project finance, acquisition finance deals. They have some equity in small to mid-cap mining companies too, plus a royalty portfolio that they built up, because when you do project finance, you often throw a bit of a royalty into the mix there. So, like, when Regal acquired Taurus, they bought that, well, the 50% of Taurus, they bought that stake from an entity that was actually 50% owned by Macquarie. There's a few things here that that I think are interesting that kind of get maybe missed in the mainstream reporting of it. One is, like, I'm not an accounting expert at all, but I think buying 50% might actually allow Regal to aggregate 100% of the FUM, so the funds under management can grow by an outsized amount. The other one is Regal, they serve that massive function in the resources market, right? People love to hate them. Phil King himself is a massive kind of – he plays a big role in the whole functioning of that hedge fund. He has relationships with bloody everyone. I imagine his phone's always going off because he's just a big name in the actual functioning and execution of that entity. The deal, to me, probably seems like more evidence that, like, Regal is hungry. A couple months ago, they had a crack at buying PAC Partners. Internally, like, in my thinking, I sort of think Regal buying other funds, in this case, they get 50% of Taurus. Taurus has its own management structure, and it diversifies Regal's sort of, you know, hedge fund business. It also reduces the reliance on Phil King from just an operational capacity too. If Regal becomes some entity that has some ownership of other managers, then you know, if you think of the key man risk of Regal and its longevity, it probably diversifies that. So I think just it'd be interesting to watch how Regal's kind of role in this industry evolves over time. I think they're hungry, right?
Well, I think, and more funds under management, and as you say, because they're long short funds, that shorting capability means whatever they short, that money comes straight to them, and then they can reinvest that straight away from that borrow. So, like, it leverages them to put a lot of money into the market. So it's it's coming. It's a bit of a powerhouse, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, mate. You went into a bit of a royalty deal.
Royalty. Speaking of royalties, mate, New World Resources (NWC) they've got the Antler Copper Project over in Arizona. So they've secured $11 million from Trident Royalties in exchange for a 0.9% net smelter royalty. And you know, sometimes you hear it, Trav, you're like, oh, geez, they're selling a big royalty of future gains for to get a bit of cash in the door early. Is it good? Is it bad? Yeah. So I'll go into what it is first, and then we've got a good little tweet that summed it up and saved me figuring it out. There's also a 0.45% royalty over any additional mineral rights they acquire within 5Ks of that Antler Copper Project. So net NSR is, for those who don't know, net smelter return. So that is the gross revenue that a company receives from the smelting of their product. So in this case, it'd be a copper concentrate. And then you take away any transportation, insurance, marketing, and refining costs. So that's what that 0.9% of that equation is what the royalty provider gets in the door. So New World, they've got the option to buy back 0.3% of that royalty for $9 million. They got the $11 million. So in future, 3 months within, when they've got 75% of the funding, they can pay $9 million to get 0.3% of that back. And or I think they can put $4 million in to buy back a portion of the 0.45% royalty as well. So look, talk about the actual royalty financing, Trav, before we go into a tweet from our good friend Respeculator.
Yeah, I think to your point where I normally comment on royalty financing when a royalty gets announced pre-FID and it's a royalty that sort of keeps the lights on. I've made comments in the past a couple of times how averse I am to those deals, but there's a difference between those deals and the one we're talking about today. When I make those comments, I'm talking about the type of assets that have massive scale and potential corporate appeal. So I made those comments in relation to SolGold. I made them in relation to like how weird it would be to see Philo do a royalty. I think I've made those comments in relation to when Hot Copper did that royalty. I've spoken a bit about that sort of stuff. And when an asset has corporate appeal, you know, like, and you remove the corporate appeal because the BHP doesn't want to bloody pay for an asset that has a royalty over it because their cost of capital is so different.
And the royalty they gave away for what they got was on such a bigger scale.
Yep.
It was
exactly
chewing into a lot of future revenue.
Yeah.
When you did the sums on it.
This is different because it's not – it's like, yeah, it's a different kind of deal. You've got smaller scale thing. It's not ever going to have the sort of corporate appeal and you're not overly encumbering – the economics that might be some benefit to doing this sort of deal. So that'd be my first point before you break it down.
Yeah, well, like Ultra Speculator did the sums very well. Good on you. I like this person, don't know male or female, but Speculator, always good insight on Twitter. So they said, look, there's 400,000 tonne of copper equivalent here, so you assume a future price of $10,000 a tonne. And that's $4 billion in revenue, 0.9% net smelter royalty brings in, you know, approximately $36 million. So deduct those marketing, insurance, smelter costs and everything. But, you know, that's the contained copper. So there's obviously some upside regarding exploration, but this seems like a decent deal for a junior, given the current cost of capital. Obviously, a royalty at the moment is non-dilutive to the existing shareholders.
Dilutive to the project.
Dilutive to the project, non-dilutive to the existing shareholders.
Yeah.
If they sell out before they mine it.
Yeah.
So if you do the maths on that, and from what he said, it appears like a pretty good royalty deal for what they're getting.
Yeah, and there's an interesting comment on the broader theme of royalty financing right now. Like, this is the second day in a row we've mentioned deals where a small cap developer have raised money via royalty. ASX companies are usually really averse to this, but that's usually because, you know, the equity markets are forthcoming, which they're not at the moment. And that current state of equity markets being so grim make the royalty finance kind of, you know, actually be explored at the moment. There's a bunch of the royalty companies out there like Trident who did this one. They all popped up, I think, over the last, you know, 7 to 5 years. And they're hungry to build out royalty portfolios. I think there's like two or three really, really big royalty companies, and then it's a big kind of step change between the rest. But everyone wants to be, a big royalty company. It's a wicked business. You only need to hire like five people, and you can have massive revenues. And this sort of market environment right now, where equity stuff, it's a perfect market to be doing deals like this and building out a royalty portfolio. So it's interesting to see entities like Trident active. Meanwhile, Maddie, the Terra listed here on the ASX still haven't done a deal.
Yeah, but they're coming on when they do a deal.
Okay.
So
I'll hold my breath. Yeah,
we should still be around in 5 years, shouldn't we? Maybe.
Oh, we will be. They won't.
Yeah, righto. We'll round it off, mate. Money Miners, we're on Cameo. So funny story, check the links in the show notes, because some a mother of a fan rang up very embarrassingly for this bloke, saying that she wanted a hat for Christmas to give her son, but we're like, we don't have any left. We'll send him a video of me and Trav talking shit and saying we'll offer him to come up here. And mate, he bloody loved it. So Ali GC signed us up for Cameo, and we've already got a sale. So, mate, if you want a personalised message, and, mate, I reckon we put JD up for $150 for a solo message from JD, because he loves that shit.
I'd pay $150 to see JD that uncomfortable.
I will pay $150 just to watch it.
If I'm uncomfortable doing this sort of stuff, like, imagine, like, I can't picture how uncomfortable he would be.
Perfect Christmas present, bloody cameo video from Money of Mine. I thrive in that environment, Trav. Believe it. Mate, thanks to all the partners. As always, Terra Capital, Anytime Exploration Services, JP Search, K-Drill, Smec Power and Technology, KCA Site Services, McMahon Mining Title Services, MMTS, Brooks Airways and Future Proof Consulting Partners. They're all bloody GCs, and thanks very much. Mate, we've got to go have a beer and lunch.
Hooteroo.
And then I've got to edit. Hooteroo, Money Miners.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation and needs.